supporting this episode of Snacks for the Brain. We're truly grateful for your interest in what we're doing to bring the joy of research and discovery to K-12 students and teachers the whole world over. Bi-weekly or so, we'll share some fun, independent, pod-safe music. We'll interview some working research scientists, students, or leading proponents of educational change. And we'll toss in an educational sound-seeing tour or computer tip.
And if it's for you, we'll be right here.
At blogs.vanderbilt.edu/S4TheB and at the CSO website at scienceoutreach.org, sharing good brain munchies with you. So listen up, let's get right down to it with episode number
82
of Snacks for the Brain.
Where the sweet magnolia grows, there's a river bend I know, where time ain't nothing to kill. It's a crazy river, it shakes and shivers. It's a want that never will. Mona took a bus to Las Vegas in a rush, 'cause she could not. Clashing, the sunshine turned to pain. I sit and I wonder how I get so far under the spell of a wasted youth, wasted time. Oh Lord, I've cast my pearls before the swine.
This is Scott with episode number 83 of Snacks for the Brain, and we're going to share some information whose source centers around the recurring celebrity of our episode number 17 subject. At that time, Dr. William Schaffner was also in the news, driven there by the media looking for answers to the then outbreak of bird flu. Huh? What? Bird flu? Don't remember bird flu? Okay, that does it. We have to have a D.O. That means do over. I'm resharing episode number 17 today because, one, chances are you didn't get to that podcast back in December 2005, and two, Dr. S says some things in it that really truly apply to the situation right here, right now. I'm also posting some links here at blogs.vanderbilt.edu/s4theb, which can lead you to many of the recent online articles and video appearances that tap Dr. Schaffner's expertise in the topic that so thoroughly saturates our airwaves, cables, and iPods these days.
Swine flu.
A quick survey of some article titles may help tickle your curiosity. Regular flu shots this fall, maybe swine jab too. That's an AP release by Lauren Neergaard, May 2nd. Stay safe from swine flu with three simple steps. From USA Today, Health and Behavior section, April 30th. Current flu outbreak has some similarity to deadly 1918 strain. That's in the Stanford Times, an article by Susan Rust, May 4th. VMC leadership urges calm in the swine flu storm. That's from the Vanderbilt Medical Center's Reporter Weekly Magazine. Flu-fighting masks may help, but don't bet on it. That's from MSNBC.com online article April 30th. Dr. Schaffner appeared in every single one of these. In the process of sorting through all these results for this, I had a brainstorm, though. Why not create a custom feed on my personalized Google News page for William Schaffner? I did that, and so can you, if you're of a mind. You can see mine complete with each of its 628 search returns as of the moment of this recording by clicking on the link at the Snacks for the Brain blog at blogs.vanderbilt.edu/s4theb. Then, I went all video with it. Switching my Google search to video mode. How many resulting links? 49. There's a screen grab from that search on the blog and a link to a nifty VO, that's VEOH.com, amalgam of video clips featuring Dr. Schaffner sharing his good doctorly advice. Finally, I took to the large video services, finding lots of returns on searches for swine flu Schaffner in digital print at msnbc.msn.com. And finally, really finally, I searched just for swine flu at msnbc.msn.com, ending up with an interesting list that contained a fascinating brief video coverage. Dr. Carl Brumback, a 95-year-old retiree who was, quote, in charge of the Palm Beach County's response to the 1976 swine flu outbreak. Dr. Brumback also comments about the 1918 outbreak, which he has lived long enough to recall. This video is also embedded at the blog. People in business at Tennessean.com noted on May 3rd that William Schaffner received the James D. Bruce Award for Distinguished Contributions in Preventative Medicine from American College of Physicians. Schaffner is chair of Vanderbilt University Medical Center's Department of Preventative Medicine.
You're listening to Snacks for the Brain.
Hello, y'all.
We need them in medical school. We need them to learn about public health because we need help in doing this job. And whatever we've accomplished, they're going to do even better things.
This is Scott Merrick from the Vanderbilt University Center for Science Outreach. Welcome you to another Snacks for the Brain. This episode, Snack 17, we visit with Dr. William Schaffner. Listen up.
With Dr. William Schaffner, and he is...
Well, I chair the Department of Preventive Medicine here at Vanderbilt, and I'm an infectious diseases doctor, and I have a special interest in diseases in the community, diseases that affect you before you get to the hospital and the clinic, and how to prevent them.
You're sort of all in the buzz these days with bird flu and pandemic and words like that flying around. So,
yeah, I link up with the folks in public health a lot, and those are all the sorts of issues that come to public attention. They make it into the headlines, and what could be more interesting than that?
I wonder how much of that is legitimate and how much of it is media-generated for ratings. I mean, what's your feeling when you see the heightened interest that big old word epidemiology might...
might bring to the table?
I'm of two minds about it. The first is we're grateful for any attention because you get a teaching moment when you can say something that perhaps some people will listen to. Working with the media is akin to giving a lecture or running a seminar. You have an opportunity to teach, except you don't see your students out there. I'm also, of course, a representative of Vanderbilt. And so on most issues, I try to be kind of moderate and middle of the road and bring down the hype a little bit. If you work with the media, it's in effect, it's their game, so you have to play a little bit by their rules, and you'd best learn how to do that if you would like to do it successfully. So you just have to cope with the hype. And yes, there's some of that. There isn't any doubt. For example, a couple of Sundays ago, I was watching Tim Russert do an interview on Meet the Press. And he was interviewing the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Leavitt, Dr. Tony Fauci from the NIH, and Dr. Julie Gerberding, who's the director of the CDC, and he was just talking about this topic, bird flu. And as I was watching, I said, you know, if I were being interviewed, I'd push back on Tim Russert a little bit, because he was asking his questions in such an absolutist fashion and investing them with so much emotion that the viewer could make the inference that he really expected perfection, that we ought to be able to respond to a possible bird flu pandemic in absolute terms and indeed perhaps even prevent it. And there was this aura about the question, not the exact words, but the aura around them, that if we weren't able to prevent a pandemic, we were slackers. Of course, that's nonsense. That's the hype.
Right.
And had I been there, I would have told Tim, tone it down a little bit, because we have to let people know what's a reasonable expectation of what we can do. We can prepare for the hurricane, but we can't prevent it. If there's a hurricane, there's going to be damage.
Right.
The trick is to minimize the damage by studious preparation on the front end and then coordinated, coherent response on the back end. And that's what we're doing, trying to do, right, in anticipating bird flu.
Well, the question all the listeners, I'm sure, will really want to hear, is there going to be a bird flu pandemic?
Let's see, where's that crystal ball? Most people who know about influenza know that periodically this virus, which is capable of changing itself, it can change itself genetically, from time to time produces a dramatically new influenza type. And when that happens, the world's population is completely susceptible, and we have a global epidemic, which we call a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that happened three times in the 20th century. In 1918, that was the worst. Then again in 1957 and in 1968. So it's been almost 40 years since the last one, and most influenza experts think that, well, I guess we're more or less due, the clock is ticking. But the pandemics don't run according to a Swiss train schedule. They'll come when an appropriate mutation takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if it's that random, why are we fretting now? And we're fretting now because the previous new influenza viruses originated from influenza viruses that affected only birds originally. Mm-hmm. And it was their genetic changes that resulted in a new human virus.
So in a sense, they were all bird flus.
That's exactly right. They were all. Bird flu is the mother of us all. If the new influenza viruses that affect humans and are capable of being transmitted efficiently from person to person originally came from a bird flu virus, it should also be noted that those new viruses originated in Southeast Asia. All of them. And so you can understand, now we have a new bird flu virus that is very, very successful. It has maintained itself in the bird population prominently for a period of years and is also spreading very widely geographically. We've never seen anything quite like that before. And of course, most of the bird flu virus is in Southeast Asia. So you put all those things together and you can see why it is we're fretting a little bit and we're worried, but that's all really. We're worried that this virus might mutate such that it suddenly
can become capable of being transmitted from person to person. And right. that's why it's in the news now.
Which is not currently the case.
It's not the case.
Right.
It's gotten into a few people in Southeast Asia, nowhere else. These are people who have had very, very close contact with these birds, by and large. That's been true of other bird flu viruses in the past. Occasionally, the virus loses its way, and instead of going from chicken to chicken, it goes from a chicken to a person. Now, once it gets into the person, it's a serious illness. It kills half of those people. But it doesn't go from person to person. It hasn't figured out, in effect, how to do that yet.
If we could anthropomorphize a little bit, we might say that it wants to.
I don't know if it wants to, but it would certainly find a lot more homes to visit. That is, all of us people around the world
right.
who would provide a host, a roosting place for this bird flu virus. It would certainly traverse the globe in a couple of years, and make most people to some degree or another ill.
Mm-hmm. But what I hear you saying is there's not cause for general alarm at this point.
I've been reminding folks that, first of all, bird flu virus is, for all intents and purposes, in birds at the moment, not in people. Mm-hmm. And it's not even in the entire Western Hemisphere. So calm down a little bit and put this into a bit of perspective. In fact, all this hoop-de-doo about bird flu has led some people to forget that annual, good old-fashioned, if you will, influenza season is almost upon us, and many people have not gotten themselves vaccinated. And so I urge folks, especially folks who are likely to develop the complications of influenza, to seek out vaccine. It's a little bit late in the season now. Not everyone has vaccine, but a little persistence, a little patience, a few phone calls, and you ought to be able to find some vaccine.
Excellent. That's a great segue, because I wanted to ask you about vaccines. What's that all about? Is it all just a battle between commercial profit and profitability and altruism? Or why are vaccines not being created in sufficient quantities to vaccinate us?
Rather than a conflict, I like to see it as a partnership, but a partnership that's not working ideally. Step back a moment. Vaccines prevent disease, all of the ones that we have. There are vaccines that are in development to try and treat illnesses, but we're talking about vaccines that get to you before the disease does and change your body in such a way that when the disease occurs, you don't get it. You're protected against the disease. And I think the protection against disease, the prevention of disease, is actually the highest goal of medicine. I'm still a stethoscope-carrying doctor. I was drawn to medicine because I wanted to lay on hands and heal the sick, humanitarian impulses. But the longer I'm in this game, the more I realize that the prevention of disease, so that people don't get sick at all, is the highest goal. I love it, for example, that we've built a Vanderbilt Children's Hospital and didn't have to build in a polio ward, because there's no polio anymore, and there's no polio because we've vaccinated everyone. So it's highly desirable. But what's happened is that vaccines are actually a low profit margin, part of the big pharmaceutical industry. And if you were the chief executive officer of a pharmaceutical industry, this is not where you would put your money. You would put your money into developing new drugs that people would have to take maybe daily for the rest of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
That's where the larger profits are. That's your responsibilities to your stockholders.
Right.
And so vaccines need extra help so that we can continue to develop new ones and have enough manufacturers in the game so that they will continue to produce vaccines and we won't suddenly be faced with a shortage, which has happened. Here it is, the 21st century, end of the 20th century. It's shocking to my friends when I tell them that we have had shortages in these vaccines that prevent their children from developing infections that bothered my mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are, the richest country in the world, and we have a somewhat insecure vaccine supply. We really need to do something about that.
So the kind of help you're talking about might be a government subsidy or program to pad the profits or What are you talking about?
Some sort of, yeah, some yeah. sort, if we regard this as a national goal and something terribly important mm-hmm. that we wish to sustain and indeed have grow, we need a partnership between government and the vaccine part of the pharmaceutical industry that will protect them against certain losses, mm-hmm. for example. And among other things, one of the things I like to do is create a new market. We have a very, very successful infant, childhood, and adolescent vaccination program, which is a public-private partnership. The vaccines are either covered under a public program or under private health insurance. That ends at the 19th birthday. Mm. And beyond that, you're basically you're on your own. Your medical insurance and mine may not cover vaccines as adults. In fact, most of the benefits packages don't cover vaccines. If we created a similar program for adults, modeled on the childhood program, mm-hmm. we would create a huge new market for vaccines. And more vaccines are being developed. They're in the research pipeline that will be aimed at adults. That will draw manufacturers in, and the whole population will reap the benefits of all this prevention. I see that as a win-win all around. Socially, good thing to do, stabilizes the market, and fewer people getting sick. Hey, what's not to like?
So how does this come about? Does this need to be something that comes out of Washington or...
Oh, it'll have
state
to,
initiatives?
Yeah, it'll have to come out of Washington. And I'm actually somewhat distressed because last season, you know, we suddenly lost one manufacturer of influenza vaccine and literally half the flu vaccine that was mm-hmm. going to come into this country, manufactured in Liverpool, England, mm-hmm. not even in this country, was lost to us. And I thought, finally, we've
Somebody's
got the
attention yeah.
of the Congress and of the executive branch. No such luck. Everybody's been preoccupied with other things, and there have been no sustained, serious hearings in Washington on this subject. So I'm a little disheartened. I'll revert to optimism if you give me a minute. But I must say I'm a little grumpy about all that.
Would you consider yourself one of those people in the world who likes to go to his work every day? And if so, why?
Oh, absolutely. I'm absolutely entranced, and it makes my wife smile because I'm so enthusiastic about it. What makes me really excited, even beyond trying to help an individual, is having the capacity to work with my colleagues in public health to make the whole population healthier. We have the capacity in the world today, really, through vaccines and other public health measures, to try to prevent an awful lot of illness. And your listeners have to remember, when I was growing up, I wasn't permitted to go swimming in the summer. And that's because my mother and father were worried about a disease they haven't heard of, poliomyelitis. It was a paralytic disease. It was a viral disease. It occurred most commonly in the summer, in the fall, and was thought to be in some fashion catching. You could get it from someone else. So you stayed away from crowds. You did not go to the movies. You didn't go swimming, and you kind of stayed by yourself. This was a disease that paralyzed arms and legs, particularly legs. That disease has been eliminated, almost eliminated from the entire world now with the use of a vaccine. And we have the capacity to organize ourselves as peoples of the world, different cultures, different languages, different political systems, to come together to try to work on projects. We've eliminated smallpox from the world, and now we're trying to eliminate completely this disease, poliomyelitis. So there's no mother, whether in Nashville or Maine or Ecuador or Africa or the Punjab in India, who has to worry that their child is going to suddenly develop a paralytic disease that will afflict them for the rest of their lives. The best reward of all that is that you can do the job so successfully that the mothers even forget about the disease. They don't even have to think about it. That's a different kind of a reward than you get when you stand next to the bedside of a sick patient and you help that very individual person get better. I find them both enormously satisfying. And then in the midst of doing both of those things, having junior people with me mm-hmm. so that they can learn about both of those kinds of activities. I can't think of things that are better than that. And since I work with infectious diseases, it's always changing. So I have to stay very much alert to nuanced changes, not just in this country, but around the world. And I think perhaps next to, I don't know, international diplomacy or something like that, which at its best tries to provide a peaceful society around the world, I think international public health may be among the more rewarding things. But heck, that's just my point of view. But that makes me get up in the morning and sing.
Well, I certainly thank you for sharing all of this with our listeners. And I understand that with luck, you'll be doing a video conference presentation from the Center for Science Outreach. Maybe as early as the springtime, but maybe next fall.
That would be fun. And I hope your listeners hurry up. We need them in medical school. We need them to learn about public health because we need help in doing this job. And whatever we've accomplished, they're going to do even better things.
Thank you, Dr. William Sheffield.
Thanks, Scott.
Visit the website http://scienceoutreach.org.
Outreach Radio.
Back off, you stand too close. I feel the breath. Snacks for the Brain is brought to you by the fine folks at the Vanderbilt Center for Science Outreach, connecting working research scientists with K-12 students worldwide. Check out the website at scienceoutreach.org.